Bill.
My name is Rick Evans. I'll always be alcoholic. I've never done this without a podium to hide behind. It's a little unnerving. I'll start out with, I always think that I should be asked to speak, but whenever I am, I get terrified about it. And then I think that's just sort of a symptom of my alcoholism. I'm the kind of alcoholic who always wants to be the center of attention, unless I am. And, I'm the kind of guy who's afraid of being alone, but I'm also afraid of being with people. And all these things that I know about myself along those lines, they were true of me before I ever started drinking, but I didn't know it. I grew up in a place in Ohio, central Ohio, a small farming village, and not a single bad thing ever happened to me. I had a good family. Everybody was nice to me. School was easy. There was just not a bad thing going on. I had no reason to drink. I never saw anybody drink. There wasn't alcohol in our house. I think I might have been at a New Year's Eve party when I was a child with my parents, and they might have had a drink or two, but that's really the only time I can ever remember it, except for people on TV. And yet, when I was 16, I drank, and it was on. I remember that I've worn glasses since I was a small child. I think like fourth grade or fifth grade or something. They came around to our elementary school and tested us, and they came back a couple weeks later and said, "You need glasses, and this is what we're gonna give you." And they put them on me, and as soon as they put those glasses on me, the world snapped into focus. I just knew instinctively that that's what it was supposed to look like. I had never seen it look like that before, but I knew that this is how it looked. And I never, ever felt that again until I drank the first time when I was 16. And as soon as it was vodka, ironically, that's what I ended up drinking too, but I drank that first drink, and it was supposed to be a screwdriver, but I don't know what it really was. And it hit me, and I was like, holy cow, this is right. This is what I've been missing. And like I said, there's no real reason for me to feel that way, but by God, I did. There was a lot of behaviors before I started drinking. I was a criminal. I was stealing from the people that I worked for as a small kid. I just started working for some neighbors when I was 12 or something, and was taking money out of their cash register for them, and I lied. Oh my God! And he couldn't get me to admit I was lying when he caught me. And I don't know what it is about me, but I'm just wired that way. And then I drink, and that stuff's able to be. It's more easy to live with it when I drink. And then the problem is, though, when I drink, I start doing more of it, which then there's something that knows that it's wrong, so I start feeling guilty, and then I, drink more. That handles it, and all of a sudden I'm another criminal. Anyhow, I drank that first time. The village I lived in only had 5,000 people, and it was tough for me to get alcohol, but I tried to get as much as possible from that point forward. I started doing other issues when I was 17. Those were a little bit easier to get, but it was alcohol that really, really, really set me off. I had two sources. One was the pedophile janitor from the elementary school. Another one was a Pentecostal preacher who made moonshine. And I had to, and I'm not bagging on the Pentecostals or any religion or anything. This is not, I never went to that kind of church, but this guy lived in southern Ohio down by West Virginia, and I got hooked up with him somehow. And I would drive, me and some other guys would drive, I guess it was about a 3-hour drive to get down there. He had his church services on Saturday night. He would make us come down to sit through the church service before he would sell us the moonshine. And he was, and he was a hardcore guy, you know, the church service, they're flopping around on the ground and they're speaking in tongues and this guy's having snakes bite him and stuff like that. And I'm just thinking, man, this is not how we do it in the Methodist church. And so we sat through it, and then after the service was over, he'd lock up the church, and we'd follow him across the holler to his house up the hill, and we'd go in, and he'd lay down a couple planks over some barrels and start breaking out the shine. And we did that pretty regular, and we're doing it as usual one night, and there was a little drive down below his house, look down on the hill, and one night we're sitting in there drinking, and obviously somebody was angry at him or somebody in the house, and they drove up and started shooting into the house. And the preacher didn't even bat an eye. He grabbed a shotgun and went over and broke out the window and started shooting back. I had enough wits about me, as did my friends, to get down on the ground and lay down and just think, holy crap, this is not what I signed up for. I'm not around stuff like this. I'm from a little middle-class farm village, you know. But I can tell you that while I was laying on the ground, probably praying, but thinking, holy cow, I hope I don't die, I caught a glance at my jug of shine up on the bar, and I thought, I wonder if I can get to that without getting killed. I didn't have the balls to do it, but I caught it. And the little firefight ended after, what, 30 seconds or something, and my buddy said, let's get the hell out of here, and we got up and went. I took my shine, they took theirs. And here's another sign that I'm different from people. My buddies never went back. But I did. I did. I got out of high school okay. I was lucky. I did good in tests, and that part of it was okay. Another sign of my alcoholism is when I got out of high school, I had an academic scholarship to Harvard University. I am not, however, a college graduate today. Other things had priority in my life. I went away to this other school, which was even more expensive than Harvard. Lasted a year before dropping out or flunking out or whatever happened to me. I hit other issues almost every day that I was there, along with drinking. I got back as an academic failure after that first year with my tail between my legs, made up some bullshit story for my parents, and signed up for classes in the local extension of Ohio State. And I'm going to class there, and one of my buddies who I party with gets arrested and gets locked up for a while because it doesn't matter, but he shot up a bunch of earth movers and stuff like this. So I went down to see him a couple times, and I started taking stuff in with me for him. And one time I went in, and they searched me, and they found it, and they kept me. I'm 19 at this point, maybe. I think I was 19. That is the only time in my life I've ever been arrested, and I was not drunk. I was loaded. I was arrested by a kid I went to high school with. The sheriff was the father of a buddy of mine from Boy Scouts. The chief of police was the father of my best friend from junior high. They caught me with these other issues, and there was enough of them to make it. And I remember sitting there getting shackled for the first time and seeing the sheriff and the chief come by and looking in and shaking their heads. And they kept me overnight because there's pretty much no way that they could get around that. I would think. But they let me out the next day, and they never pressed charges. I'm not sure that those guys did me any favors by doing that. But I got out, and all this crap's going down. I knew that I couldn't understand how I was doing this, why I was doing this. And, you know, another thing, I got out of jail that day, and I had this shaving kit full of other issues and a little bit of other issue on top of it and stuff, and it was in the front seat of my car. Actually, it was in the front seat of my dad's car. He had gotten down and picked it up, and he looked through, and he saw the the green leafy other issue on top and threw it out, but he didn't look below it to see the other ones. So I got out of jail that, hey, you know what it's like when you're 19, you have to go to your parents' house, maybe you don't, but when you have to go back to your parents' house and you've just been arrested for the first time, and it's a lot of awkwardness, extreme discomfort. And what I wanted more than anything was to get loaded, but there's, well, they ain't going to let me out to go get booze. I had nothing going for me, so they left me alone for a minute and went outside probably to think about what the hell they were going to do with me, and I went and found that shaving kit, and I found out he had left these other issues in there, and I took them all. It wasn't enough to kill me or anything, but I was way loaded. And at that moment, my mom decides to drive me up to the Girl Scout camp and have a heart-to-heart with me about why I'm behaving like this. I couldn't even freaking walk hardly. But I remember trying to explain to her why I did it, and I couldn't explain it. I knew that I just wanted it, that somehow it was right. And I hated the way I made them feel. I hated the way it made me feel when that stuff happened. But I knew that there was probably no real way out. I moved away from that town to get into a bigger town further away from my parents so I could pursue what I wanted to do more heavily. Things didn't get better. I kept doing what I was doing. My buddies kept doing what they were doing. And it was pretty good stuff. My wife loves this story, so I'll tell it real quick. It's some alcoholic stuff that has some severe consequences. This really has none, but it's a sign of the kind of alcoholic I was. We lived in this house, me and my buddies, in Columbus, which is a cold place to live, and we didn't pay our gas bill because we were using it to buy other stuff with, so they shut it down, so the house was cold. We fortunately had a fireplace, so we burned all our furniture, and then the furniture was gone. And one of the guys, one of my roommates, took the extreme step of getting a job. He got a job in a lumber yard so he could bring home the scrap lumber, and we kept burning that. Again, though, we would not invest in a saw or an axe. We just had these big pieces of lumber that wouldn't fit in the house. So it's an icy day one day. It was Saturday morning. I do remember that. And me and one guy are just in the house doing what we're doing. And it involved alcohol for sure. And I went out to get more wood. We set it up on the porch railing and jumped on it to break it. So I set it up there and I jumped on it. And it slipped and spun around and drove a 16-penny nail right into my ass. And in a tuba fore, in a 12-foot tuba fore. And it was nailed onto me like you would not believe. I couldn't get it off. I started shouting for my buddy, and he came out of the house finally, and after he got done laughing, he started trying to get it off. And he couldn't get it off. So it was too big. I couldn't walk because I had to like bend over and try and it didn't really, and maybe it hurt, I don't know, but it wasn't hurting me at that point. So we ended up having to get into the back of this big old station wagon so that they could haul me down to the hospital, and they hauled me into the hospital with this 2x4 nails to me. I swear to God, I mean, my buddy was like, ah! And it just wouldn't come out. So, you know, I know this is funny, and I know people are going to laugh when I do it, when I talk about it, but then I'm laughing, and you guys start laughing, and it hurts my feelings. Is that fucked up, or what? So we get down there, and we get into the Ohio State University Hospital, and the doctors and nurses are coming out, they're looking around the corner, they used the bone saw and sawed it off, and I got a tetanus shot. It had not one single consequence from it except for the bill. Now, that is not really all that unusual of the kind of thing that would happen to me when I drink. And that's only kind of a comic one that, you know, there's other stuff that starts going down that's pretty gnarly. I'm starting to go to jail again at this point. every other time I've been in jail has involved alcohol. I don't know how many times I've been in jail, and I've never been in jail more than a night. But it's at least 24 and probably closer to 50. I've been arrested for drunk driving 3 times in 3 states. I've been arrested for drunk walking. I've been arrested for drunk fighting. I've been arrested for drunk breaking and entering. And I've been arrested for drunk bicycling and drunk sleeping. Those are the ones that I can remember. Every time I got arrested, it made me feel terrible. And I always wanted to figure out how to not get arrested, but I never wanted, never, ever wanted to not drink. I'm burning through girlfriends and stuff, and things are going bad. I'm starting to screw around with suicide attempts. I get hooked up with this woman, and it's one of those alcoholic things where I slept with her, and then we ended up getting married just because I didn't know how to not get married. And, she was a pharmacist, too, so they were respectful. Unfortunately, women that would put up with somebody like me were probably also a lot like me, and that was a really rotten marriage. As a result of that marriage, I attempted suicide again, and that was shortly before that marriage ended, and I lived through that one again, too, and I'm just thinking, this is screwed up. But shortly after that marriage ended, I'm selling other issues, and I apologize about talking about this, but this, I believe, is one of the reasons I'm alive. I was selling other issues to quadriplegics and paraplegics in Columbus. There was a residence for them down by OSU, and I would get them what they wanted and step all over it because they couldn't catch me. And then this one dude, most of them were okay, but there was one guy, I don't know his name, I don't remember what he looked like, but he was completely paralyzed. He ran his chair by blowing in a tube. And I would get him high, and until the drugs wore off, he would sit in his chair, blown in the tube, and spun in circles. And I had a moment, that was my first significant moment of clarity, which was, if I do this again, that's a possible outcome. And if I do it myself, there's not going to be a big lawsuit against anybody with a big paycheck allowing me to have people come in and give me what I want. I'm just going to be stuck there, thinking. And I already knew that. I was probably going to AA because of the courts at that point, but I was not even close to not drinking. That was around 1984, and I didn't get to get sober then. I should have said this. My sobriety date is approximately February 3rd of 1991. As of last week, I celebrated about 18 years. And I say about because it's good chance it's not February 3rd, and there's a chance it's not even February, but it's close. It is definitely 1991, though. But from 1984 up until 1991, I didn't get to quit drinking. I didn't get to kill myself. I just had to wish I was dead every day and drink. I kept going, doing the stuff we do. I wrecking cars. I'm 30 years old. I'm wrecking my dad's car because I'm 30 years old and I'm an alcoholic and I don't have one of my own. On Christmas Eve, this is another good one. I totaled it on Christmas Eve, driving from my house to their house to spend Christmas with them. I'm blacked out. All I remember is getting out of the car and being all bloody and stuff. And I come out of the blackout and I'm chained to a hospital bed in some clinic somewhere. And there's a window out there, and I see the cops and my parents standing out there, and I go, oh, my God. And I realize it's Christmas Eve, and the cop comes in, and he says, we're going to let you go with your parents. And I said, please take me to jail. Please take me to jail. bad enough trying to put up with that stuff, but put up with it on Christmas, and they made me go with my parents. And I'm 30 years old. I'm afraid to be with my parents. And again, I'm stuck with them, and I'm 60 miles from where I live, and they ain't letting me out to go get the beer I want. And I'm DTing pretty good, and every 15 minutes on television, they got one of those commercials about, do you or someone you know have a problem with alcohol or drugs? And there's tension in the house, but I put up with it for a couple days until I could get back down to where I live. And as soon as I got away from my parents, my first stop was the liquor store. Every single time I got out of jail, all those 25 or 30 or 50 times, the first thing I did, except for the first time, like I said, was stop at the liquor store. I used to sell my blood so I could get money. You do what you got to do. All this time, I'm usually able to get a job and hang on to it for a while. I end up usually almost always having to leave the jobs, sometimes willingly, sometimes unwillingly, but I can always get it together and clean up enough to start over. That's the only thing I was ever good at, I think, is starting over. And the other problem with that is every time I started over, it got harder. That's the progressive part of it for me. It's just tough. It's tough. It's tough. So, again, Christmas time, my girlfriend has broken up with me. She doesn't want to put up with my drunken bullshit anymore, so I steal her ATM card and clean out her savings account and her checking account 2 weeks before Christmas. I was too drunk to realize that I was looking at the camera while I was doing it, but once I sobered up enough to realize that, I knew that I had to get the hell out of Dodge, because this wasn't going to be a good one. This wasn't going to be a one-nighter, so I bailed and I actually tried to emigrate to New Zealand. They wrote back to me and said, "We do not want you to live here, and as a matter of fact, please don't even visit." So I got to California, and I figured that was far enough, and I managed to not get sent back and do what I needed to do. I lasted out here a couple of years, another start over, another screw up, whatever, it's all bad. At this point, the other issues are all gone. There's no, once in a while, somebody I'm with has some, I'll do it, but I'm a booze dude now. It's at the corner. I don't have to do anything. I can just go get it. Hey, it's Christmas again. Surprising, huh? So my brother comes and stays with me for a couple weeks this last Christmas in 1990 and screws up my drinking because I can't drink the way I want to when he's there. So I'm trying to hold on to my job and deal with it and not let him see how screwed up my life is. And he leaves a couple days after New Year's, and I'm like able to drink again. So I start going at it, and I make it a week or two like that, and I realize I'm not going to be able to go to work. So I call my boss at this job and tell him that I can't come to work anymore because I'm in jail. And I haven't even been in jail for years, but I didn't want to tell him I was too drunk to get out of bed. At that point, somewhere around that time, then I go ahead and switch off the telephone machine and the telephones. I'm renting this room from this woman who owns the house, and coincidentally, there's been a leak, so all the walls are screwed up, and the carpet's gone, and there's nothing but a mattress. And I go out, and I stock up on my drink of choice, which at that point was plastic half-gallons of Lucky Vodka. I would drink the ones out of the glass, but I usually broke them, so I had switched to plastic. And from that point on, I tried to drink until I died. I tried harder than I had ever tried. And I went at it. And I remember at one point, too, I actually even went to a motel room to try and do the Leaving Las Vegas thing before I ever knew about that movie. And I tried and tried. I took in two big suitcases full of vodka, and I drank them all, and I was alive. when I get to that stage, and this is not the only time I've ever been at that stage, I drink around the clock. I drink for a couple hours, I pass out, I'm unconscious for a couple hours, and then I regain consciousness. After I regain consciousness, I take another hit of that lucky vodka and I throw up on myself again. And then after I get done throwing up, I start drinking more vodka and that second shot usually stays down. And then, again, alcoholism, you know, unless we can again experience the ease and comfort which comes from that first drink. It wasn't the first drink and I'm throwing up, but that second drink would do it. He usually only did it for 30 seconds or 3 minutes or maybe an hour. But for that time, it was okay. There was going to be a way out of this. But that time always ended. And it always ended faster and faster. And then I'm just drinking because... And then all of a sudden I realize I don't want to be alive again. And I got to drink. And I drink until I pass out. It usually only took a couple hours, like I said. And then I'm unconscious for 2 or 3 hours. And I repeat. During this run, as in several others, there's no bathrooms involved. There's no anything. I'm just laying there, me and my body and my filth and my vodka. Apparently towards the end of the beginning of February, I ran out of vodka again, or I was getting close to running out of vodka, and I had no money, and I'm thinking, I got to do something. I'm going to be out, and this is going to be a really bad detox. And I was good at detox because I used to detox myself a couple times a year. My criteria was when I could no longer read my own writing, it was time to take 3 days off. And I would do that, and I'd shake it out, and then I could read my own writing again. I'd start up. So anyhow, this one was coming down. I decided it's time to start tapering off. So I start doing it, trying to mellow out the shakes, and I know I'm going to have to go out and figure out a way to get a job again, so I turn the telephone back on. And I might be wrong about this, but my memory is that as soon as I turned the phone on, it rang. It could have been 2 minutes, it could have been 20 minutes, and to tell you the truth, it could have been 2 days, but I tell you for sure that the very first time I answered the phone, after that binge, it was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my boss from that last job had told him to call me, and he calls and he identifies himself. I knew him. He had been a member of the club I was working at. And he said, hi, my name's Sid. He said, hi, Richard. This is Sid. Sid C, whatever his last name was. And I said, oh, hi, Sid. How are you? And he says, I'm doing pretty well. And as soon as he said his name, I knew that, I realized he was calling because he was a sober member of AA. I'd known that. I thought, fuck. But he says, how you doing? And I lied to him. I said, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. And then he says, he laughed. I hated him again. He asked me another question. He says, what have you been up to? I lied again. I said, nothing. I've just been going to some meetings. I think, what the hell's wrong with me? I hadn't been in a meeting of AA for 3 years. I had no intention of going to an AA meeting. He laughed again because he went to AA meetings. He knew I wasn't going. And he said, what he said was, that's great. How about you tell me where you live, and I'll come over, and we'll go to a meeting together. And I didn't lie to him. I told him where I lived. It was a Saturday morning, I know that for sure, because my last drunk meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous was that night in San Pedro. And I spent the rest of that afternoon drinking for those of you with a medical background, I was titrating the exact amount of vodka necessary to demonstrate that I had not been drunk for the last 3.5 weeks. So nobody would know. I took the first shower in that time. I threw on a bunch of Old Spice or something like that and was drinking right up to the time he rang the doorbell. And I let him in. Actually, I just opened the door. I wouldn't let him in. I just went out with him, and we took off, and he took me over to the speaker meeting. And it was in a big auditorium, way bigger than this place. And it was the speaker was the former CEO of Black & Decker or something like that, and Sid knows everybody, and everybody would go back. He'd introduce me to him. I'm like, I did not even want to be with you, let alone know any of these other people. And he'd take me. We go inside, and I'm always a shoe section kind of guy. I'm always in the back row. And he takes us right down front of the speaker meeting in front of these hundreds of people to the speaker and sits us down. It comes to the point of the meeting where they ask for anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the first time in those dozens, if not hundreds, of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I stood up and said, my name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. I do not remember hardly anything Jerry said. He was a speaker that night, and I got to know him after that. I remember something about donuts, he said, but that's really about it. And I left that meeting and sit going, hey, anybody going out? Where are you guys going for coffee? And I'm going, please, God, don't make me spend any more time with these people. And we didn't have to go out for coffee or anything. He just dropped me off, and we made arrangements that he would pick me up the next morning. And I went in, and I looked at my bottle of Lucky Vodka sitting on the counter, and I didn't drink any. I don't think I slept much that night. But the next morning was a morning meeting over at the TLC Club, the Torrance Lomito Lano Club, and he picked me up for that 8 o'clock morning, and that was my first sober meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the grace of a higher power revealed to me in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, out of the big book, an action of men like Sid and some of the other guys who I've been fortunate enough to sponsor throughout the years, I've not had to have a drink since that night. I was willing to not drink. What I'm here to tell you, I misunderstood the word willing when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous this time. I thought willing meant cheerful and enthusiastic, and I'm here to tell you it does not. It meant pissed off, bitter, and angry. But I just went. There's no way I'm going to get a job. I might burn that bridge. I'm physically incapable of working, so I sold off whatever 401ks and that kind of crap I had and just lived off that and borrowed money on credit cards. And I always had good jobs. I just couldn't keep good jobs. So for 3 months, I just went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not get sober in a recovery home. I've never lived in a recovery home. Those of you who do, hang on to it tight because it's rough doing it without it. I went to meetings several times a day usually. Sometime in that first 90 days, I realized that I wasn't pissed off anymore. I caught myself smiling once in a while and not hating everybody in the room. You know, it took me a long time. There's two kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Boy, I'm barely even sober and time's up. There's two kinds of people in the rooms of AA. The people that were nice to me when I was there, they were the simple-minded morons. And they were the people that ignored me or weren't as nice as I thought they should be. And they were the insensitive bastards. That's the only people out there. Today, that's not the kind of people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to stay sober. I got to get a job at 3 months sober. I kept it for 3 months, quit it, got another job. I got back into my profession, which is running bars, of all things. Shortly after that, I still work in a bar today. I'm here to tell you I do it a hell of a lot better after 18 years sober than I ever did while I was drunk. I got another job a year or so later. I was going to this other meeting, and this woman started stalking me, and she's here because I married her. I'm never seen Carol drink, she's never seen me drink, and I pray to God that neither one of us ever has to see that. We got married when we were about 5 years sober, 4.5 years sober, something like that, and been married for, what, 13 years, almost 14, something like that, 13 and a half. We've lived in four counties sober, Los Angeles, Orange County, Riverside County, and Mount Visalia. Throughout each of those counties, I have had sponsors. When I first moved to Orange County, I didn't get one for a while, so I figured, you know, I'm 7 years sober. I got this thing wired. I'm in my old home group, the Thursday night men's Anderson SAG meeting in Irvine. And this recent transplant from Texas gets up and shares, and he talks about showing somebody sponsors himself, and he'll show you a good example of what unskilled labor can produce. I went up and asked him to sponsor me that night, and when we moved to Riverside County, I got another sponsor. He died with 44 years sober a couple years ago, and I got another sponsor after that. I moved to Riverside, I moved here to Visalia last year, and got a sponsor. I spoke on the phone today with a guy that I sponsor, Phil, to a certain extent. He lives in Torrance. On Friday night, he will have 16 years sober. When he asked me to sponsor him, I wasn't going to do it. I was hanging out with the guys like me, the young guys, the cool guys, the guys that did the other issues, working with a bunch of them. And this guy was older. He was already retired. He'd never been arrested. He was still married to the same woman. I didn't have nothing in common with him. So I talk about it. I pray about it. I talk to people. They say, go ahead and give him a chance. So I start sponsoring him, and 16 years later, he's the only one of all those guys whose name I even know. He's also one of the very damn few guys I ever sponsored that stayed sober. But I did. The action of the 12 steps on my life is astonishing. The peace, the comfort, the serenity, all that stuff I feel on a regular basis, that's all just gravy, though. I wake up in the morning and I don't wish I'm dead anymore. If that's the only thing I ever got out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have been way overpaid. But it's not the only thing I ever got. I got to be a citizen, almost. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a sleazy, low-life, petty criminal with really good jobs. Today, I have a really good job, and I'm not a sleazy, low-life, petty criminal. However, there's another distinction that I had when I got here. I was a selfish, dishonest son of a bitch who would rather be alone anyhow. Today I still am, but nobody really knows that, unless I tell you, and that's because of the action of the 12 steps, like I said. During my birthday month, I carry this with me, the Mansfield, Ohio Alcoholics Anonymous, Ed Evans, June 4th, 1948. That's my grandfather. This is his sobriety chip. My father gave that to me a couple of years ago. My father, he and I did not have a good thing going for a lot of years, he came out and gave this to me and told me he thought I might appreciate it. He's given me cakes at meetings, and on Sunday I'm flying back because he's not doing very well. I knew I'd cry somewhere. I guess this is going to be it. I doubt he's really going to die right now, but he's on his way. But that relationship has been healed. Everything between he and I is current. I tell him I love him. He still doesn't tell me he loves me, but I don't think he's really capable of it. Although he did slip out of him once a couple months ago by accident. Another thing about what it's like now as opposed to what it used to be like, when I go back, when my mom, when my parents come out to see me, when they leave or when I leave, my mom cries. She used to cry when I got home. That's some cool shit. That is some cool stuff. If you're new or relatively new, do not give up. If you don't think you can do it, I'm here to tell you you can. I'm here to tell you you can. Do the things you're here to do. Go to meetings, get a sponsor, do all this lame-ass bullshit you hear in every meeting. And if you do it, you just might get a chance to get a great life. I believe it says on page 133, I know it says on 133, it says that I believe that this is God's will. It says that we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. I have that choice available to me. When before, when I got here, the only thing I had available to me was more alcohol. I no longer had the power of choice. And back on page 25, that's where I was living. Had but two alternatives, go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable existence as best I could, or the other to accept spiritual help. Eventually I took the spiritual help. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I still take spiritual naps, and I've had a couple spiritual comas in my sobriety, but none of them have been sufficient to force me to drink anymore. Everything about life is really good. There's just two more things, and then I'll quit. There's a quote which is ironic. It's Lincoln's birthday or something like that. And I used to think this was him, but I looked it up, and apparently he never said this. But it sounds like something he should have said. To the extent that I've experienced any success in my life, the credit belongs to God. To the extent that I've experienced failure, the responsibility is mine. That was taught to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last thing is that about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, I was going to meetings. This guy came in from Ohio to lead these workshops at this roundup, and I got to know him a little bit. It turns out that 30 years ago, we were in the same city at the same time in different jails. But this is how he closes when he does a pitch like this, and I'm going to close with it as well. My higher power reveals himself to me through other people. I want you all to know that you are like big, beautiful stained glass windows. I can see the light of God shining through each one of you. Thank you.